If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. This week, I'm on a work trip in Iceland, so I'm going to share a two-part podcast from a recent panel I moderated at Duke University on the struggle for equality in global women's soccer. It's a terrific panel. UK-based Jean Williams is one of the world's leading scholars on women's soccer and a professor at the University of Wolverhampton. She's on Twitter at Jean M. Williams. Shireen Ahmed is a Toronto-based writer and activist whose work includes the Burn It All Down podcast and the blog Tales from a Hijabi Footballer. She's on Twitter at _ShireenAhmed_. And Gwendolyn Oxenham, a former Duke soccer player, is the author of two books, including Under the Lights and In the Dark, Untold Stories of Women's Soccer. She's on Twitter at Gwen Oxenham. This panel discussion focuses on global soccer and came after a different panel focusing on U.S. soccer that included former U.S. women's national team captain Carla Overbeck, North Carolina coach Anson Dorrance, and agent Dan Levy. Part one of our global panel will be in this podcast, and part two will be released later this week. I think you'll really enjoy this discussion.
Well, welcome back, everyone. We're going to just get started for the second panel. And I'm just going to introduce Grant Wall, who we're really excited could come up and come down and moderate this panel. Grant Wall, of course, is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He has a great new book out coming called The Masters of Modern Soccer that's out May 1st, I think. Also has a Planet Football podcast that is wonderful. And And I'm on it this week, so it's even more wonderful.
Talking about his new book.
Talking about my new book. Okay, thank you, Grant. This is a good tag team thing. Yeah, okay. You can come whenever you want. He'll be leading, moderating this panel, and we're really excited to have you. So
thanks. Well, I wanted to thank all of you for coming. Thank Laurent for organizing this. Thank Duke for having us down here. It's a really good group. I'm going to start just by introducing folks here. This is going to be a discussion about equality in women's soccer from a global perspective. We got kind of a U.S. perspective on the first panel. So we're going to go global here. We got some great folks. I'm going to start with, right next to me here, Gwendolyn Oxenham, is a former Duke soccer player and the author of Under the Lights and In the Dark, Untold Stories of Women's Soccer, and another book called Finding the Game, 3 Years, 25 Countries in the Search for Pickup Soccer. She also directed Pelada, a documentary about the global game, and she's on Twitter at Gwen Oxenham. Next to her is Shireen Ahmed. Shireen is a Toronto-based writer, public speaker, and sports activist focusing on Muslim women in sports. Shireen has written for several top publications, and she also has a terrific blog, Tales from a Hijabi Footballer. She has a really cool podcast called Burn It All Down, which is terrific and which you should listen to. She's currently working on her first book, and she is on Twitter at _ShireenAhmed_. And then Jean Williams is a renowned scholar on women's soccer. She has come all the way from the UK for this. She is a professor at the University of Wolverhampton and has written 4 books, A Game for Rough Girls, A Beautiful Game, International Perspectives on Women's Football, Globalizing Women's Football, Europe, Migration, and Professionalization, and most recently, A Contemporary History of Women's Sport, Part 1, Sporting Women, 1850 to 1960. Jean is presently the academic lead for the National Football Museum, which is in Manchester, and is a fantastic place to visit if you ever get a chance in Manchester. I've been there. She's on Twitter at Jean M. Williams. So thanks, guys. There's lots to talk about here, and I just want to start kind of with each one of you. And I guess we'll start with Jean first. About what is your work focused on, if you could give people here a sense of what that focus has been?
Thank you, Grant. My work is mainly focused on the history of women's football. So I've looked at women's football games going back to 1869 that we've identified. Most of you will know formation of the Football Association in 1863. So relatively soon after, we have evidence of women's football games. And it's really been tracing that hidden history of women's soccer. And most recently, I'm really excited to be working with the National Football Museum in Manchester, England, because we have a collection that was bought from a US collector called Chris Unger, who some people here may have met. And he amassed, during his lifetime, 25,000 items of memorabilia around the history of women's soccer. So that's 92 boxes. And I'm currently on box 50.
Shereen, you want to go next?
Sure. Thank you. As Grant mentioned, I'm Canadian. So I look at things from a very different perspective. My current passion is a co-host of a podcast called Burn It All Down. It's a podcast of five women looking at sports and intersections of social justice and politics from an intersectional feminist perspective. I know that's a mouthful. I focus on my own sports writing and research. I focus a lot on the intersections of race and gender in sport. I look and often rant about systems of misogyny and racism, xenophobia in sport federations globally. So I'm not specific to soccer, although it's my passion. I consider myself a footballer still. I like to say I started left bench at the University of Toronto. So, that's some of the work that I do, and it obviously intersects. All the work I do does inherently seem political, because the work I do in sports always has been political. So that's my spiel.
Hi, I'm Gwendolyn Oxenham. I played here at Duke when I was 16. I was the youngest D1 athlete in the NCAA. And then by 20, I was kind of washed up and wasn't the best player in the world, wasn't even the best player on my team. The U.S. Women's Pro League folded the year I graduated, so there was no place for me to go, which kind of created, I was lucky in that it created a new dream to travel around the world playing in pickup games. So we went to 25 countries, which allowed me to see the game on sort of a grassroots level, what soccer looks like for men, women, boys, and girls. And then my most recent book, I was watching the 2015 World Cup, and while I knew a lot about what it meant to be a U.S. player, Alex Morgan, Abby Wambach, I had no idea what it meant to be a woman's professional soccer player in any other country. I mean, who knows what it's like to play professional soccer in Nigeria if you're a woman. I mean, I knew that Nigeria had a league and that it was one of the oldest in the world, but what it looked like, what that meant, I had no idea. So I basically went on a giant scavenger hunt to find out, and the stories kind of blew my mind that I found. I mean, there were little bits in the news, but you get a sentence. You get a sentence that says, oh, Farrah Williams was homeless for 7 years while she was playing on the English national team. So Farrah Williams is the most capped player of all time in English football history, and she was homeless while on the national team. And I don't know if anything better highlights the disparity between the men's and women's game when you consider that, you know, she scores a goal at Euros in 2015 and then returns to her hostel, which is what they call a shelter in England. Meanwhile, the men are making multi-millions. There's Nadia Nadim, who's like, I mean, just the coolest and most amazing woman in the world. She fled Afghanistan After her father was executed by the Taliban, she and her family of sisters and her mother the back of a truck arrived in Denmark, and then she learned how to play in refugee camp. Now she's the star of the Danish team, as well as like a semester away from being a surgeon. She's just ridiculous. She's also the smartest, most dynamic woman ever. There's Alinko. She's a Nigerian national team player who, when the scout showed up at the, you know, at her door and her corrugated tin home, her father said, "I'll have you arrested if you don't leave." And she begged her father and said, like, "I will kill myself if you do not let me play." Fast forward 10 years, and little by little, with the money that she's making playing professional women's soccer, she's able to buy a plot of land, build a house for her mother. And when her mother sits down on a couch for the first time in her life, she just starts sobbing and says, like, "Never in my lifetime did I think something like this would happen to me. If I'm dreaming, don't let me wake up." So, I mean, so there's a way that professional women's soccer has completely changed her life, yet obviously there's so many problems and challenges to overcome in the women's game.
Under the lights and in the dark. available on Amazon. I want to ask Jean here, and I'm going to ask each person. This will be a wide-ranging conversation. There's a lot of topics to address. But I wanted to ask Jean specifically if she could discuss some of the things that have stood out to her from your research of women's soccer sort of pre-1970s and 80s, because I think there might be some things that surprise people about the history of women's soccer being richer than maybe they suspected.
Yeah. A lot of my work is recovering the history of women's soccer, because the dominant narrative about women's soccer is one that infantilizes it, which is to say that women's soccer is new, it's progressing, it's in its infancy or it's in its adolescence. No, it isn't. You cannot have a 150-year-old baby. So if it's been around since at least 1869... and I'm only on box 50, then we know that there's a much more varied history to go. So the history of women's soccer is the history of soccer. So just in the same way that historians of the women's game have to know every in and out of the men's game, not always historians of the male game take the time to know about the women's game. And in fact, there's a very well-known book that calls itself A Global History of Soccer, 800 pages long, and it has 11 references to women throughout its pages. So it's not what I would consider to be a global history of women's soccer. So the fact that it's so old is the first thing to say. Second thing is the clothing and the right to resources, and this is something that we're still contesting. The things that are being contested in women's soccer today are the things that have always been contested. So a right to the pitch. A right to take over large pitches with spectacle, a right to wear the same soccer kit as men wear. So it's different than field hockey, it's different than netball or basketball or other kinds of sports, because the women's uniform has always been the same as the men's uniform and played to the laws of the game. I suppose we jump forward then to 1895-6, and the first pro soccer games for women were professional in intention. So we heard a little bit on the earlier panel about the importance of amateur athletics, but actually the first women's soccer players wanted their play to be spectacular. They drew large audiences. We have 1881, a Scotland versus England game. It wasn't a national game. It was two teams that called themselves Scotland, England, played in front of large crowds, paying audiences, and were able to sustain a semi-professional model for a couple of years. 1895-96, over 100 games were then played as professional soccer games on large pitches, drawing large crowds. And then going back to 1921 in England, the FA ban women's football from the grounds of clubs affiliated affiliated to the association, and they say that it's an unsuitable game for girls. So for a couple of generations within living memory, from the 1920s to the 1960s, late 1960s, when FIFA takes over women's soccer again, it seemed to be an unsuitable and unspectacular activity, and that just wasn't the case before the ban. So that they're the key highlights, I would guess. Maybe the fact that there were unofficial Women's World Cups in Italy in 1970 and Mexico in 71. And I was there in the Rose Bowl in 99 with a crowd of 93,000. But these games, these unofficial World Cups in Mexico particularly, drew crowds of over 100,000 to the final. The opening game of that tournament drew a crowd of 80,000. So when we're saying that women are pioneers and developing new aspects of soccer, we have to look at history to see that actually a lot of these pioneering developments had already taken place before.
I really do hope, as someone who works at Fox Sports, which broadcasts the World Cups, men's and women's, that for Women's World Cup next year, we do some stories about the pre-FIFA World Cup history, because I think there would be some fantastic things to show. Because a lot of the stuff, even pretty hardcore soccer fans, don't know about the history of women's soccer. Shireen, I wanted to ask you, one area that you've done a fair amount of work in is on hijab in France and its connection to soccer. And I was wondering if you could describe what that work is involved.
Just want to say two things. Every time Jean says something, I want to tweet it because she's amazing. And I can't because I don't have my phone. Also, Gwendolyn looked at me when she was talking about Nadia Nadim, because just to reassure you, I'm not wearing a Man City men's kit. It's a Man City women's kit, because I know right now everyone's like, why would she wear that publicly?
With whose name on the back?
With Nadia Nadim's name on the back. I totally stan her. She's amazing. And the work that I've done has included generally exclusion. I talk about exclusion, and I also tie this in with the control of women's bodies by sports federations. This is how I sort of weave sport into that. Now, hijab was also the way that hijab bans and exclusion of Muslim women and Sikh men and Jewish men who wear kippah, this is all a part of it, because that was all folded in to the FIFA hijab ban that was formally enacted in 2007. Now, why I care about this is because I played for the University of Toronto for 2 years. I don't want to age myself tremendously, but mid-90s. And I started to wear a hijab, and then I called my coach, and it was pretty much a thanks for coming out. There was no policy saying that I could not wear it, but there was no policy stating that I could. So what ends up happening is FIFA is very literal with their, you know, equipment manuals and their policies. So what ended up happening was it would defer to the referees, who would then just say no. The officials would just say no. And we know this happens in football all the time. So let it go. It wasn't a big deal. Well, it was actually a very big deal, because when you identify with something so personally like sport, to have it ripped away from you is horrific in many ways. Now, that's a just sort of preamble. Moving forward, in 2007, I was momming, totally doing my thing. There was a young woman in Canada named Asman Mansour, and she was playing a tournament in Quebec, and she wore a team from Ottawa, and she was excluded from play. Now, her team ended up withdrawing from this tournament, and then her club and coach filed a complaint to the CSA, which is the Canadian Soccer Association, who had no idea how to handle that then, and still really don't have any idea how to handle anything. And so they directly, I mean, yeah, that's another panel. They ended up contacting FIFA, who, as you know, spectacularly have no idea how to handle anything when it comes to women's soccer. So they ended up saying, oh my gosh, we need a policy. So they created a policy. The policy they created that you weren't allowed to have, and this ties into France, you weren't allowed to have religious objects. Now, if any of you have seen Kaká play, Jesus Owns Me on a t-shirt underneath his kid, pinning down, tattoos, crosses, you know, players from all over the world celebrate their goals in different forms of worship. Before they get on the pitch, they will sign themselves with whatever, whether it's prayer. We've seen Frédéric Canute do like Demba Ba prostrates, Mo Salah, for all you Elsie fans. You all know what that prayer is now. because he does it after every single goal. Now, they said they didn't want any religious affiliation on the pitch, but then they couldn't do that because it would affect all the men players. So they had to think of something else really smart and witty. So what did this room of the ex-co come up with? Safety. It's a safety hazard. Having a headscarf would be a safety hazard. Although, and I will tell you this in my research, which is over 8 years, there is not one federation in the world that has a documented case of a hijab hurting the player or the opponent. I know this because I've been looking for it. And if it existed, it would be plastered all over the place. There is none. So 2014, after a lot of mobilization, finally FIFA says, March 1st, 2014, we're going to allow hijab. This happened because of a couple of key players, Moya Dodd, who is, I consider her a guardian of the game. She is, for me, one of the most formidable people in the world of soccer. She's with the Australian Football Federation, and she also is with the Asian Football Confederation. She, with Prince Ali bin Hussein of Jordan, who is like a legit prince, like he's a prince, and I know it sounds so weird. He bankrolled this whole thing, the campaign, to get medical research done. And it mattered. I mean, this is the whole point. These decisions are made at tables of men who do not care, and it does not affect them. But there was somebody at the table, because our Prince Ali was vice president at the time. So it mattered. It mattered to him because in his federation, although there were no headscarf-wearing women, no one had chosen to wear it. It's not mandatory in most Muslim-majority countries to wear a headscarf. There's only three that you have to, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, and two of those don't even have a women's team. So, I mean, this is important to keep in mind when we talk about context, right? Not every Muslim woman who plays soccer wears a headscarf, and not every country impresses their woman that they have to. So Jordan, and this prince bankrolled it. He bankrolled the entire campaign because it cost a lot of money. So anyway, thankfully the medical, the IFAB, the governing council of FIFA said, okay, you know what? There was prototypes of hijabs. Women are at the forefront of creating solutions to the problems that men create. And so women came with, hey, this is a medical problem. We're going to design a hijab that meets those requirements. And that's what women did. They came, they brought ideas. And so really FIFA had no choice. And so that's what happened. Now, this is where we get to the fun part. So there's one country, one federation in the world that still refuses to allow this, and that would be France, our dear France. And for any of you that follow that country politically, socially, in that sense, you understand there's a huge, huge problem with not new immigrant countries, because French and North Africans have been there for decades and decades and decades. Now there's a problem with what is a huge piece of xenophobia and anti-Islam. This is the baseline of most of these policies are discriminatory, and in this case it is. They vilified a hijab on the pitch, although some of the greatest glorious moments of that country were brought at the feet of an Algerian Berber football player, who is the greatest, we know, Zizou, love him. So there's that. Now France is not moving forward, they're not budging. They're like, no, we have a bunch of white feminists who are now saying it is oppressive for Muslim women to wear hijab. Have they ever had a conversation with Muslim women in hijab? No, but that's not the point. This feminism will tell you that these women who cannot speak for themselves, because you won't give them the mic, cannot do this. So essentially, I wrote a piece last year for a magazine called Unusual Efforts. I'm going to wrap up quickly. I interviewed a young woman named Sarah, who is a Libyan descent in France. And I said to her, you started playing and you fell in love. And she says, I couldn't prevent myself from falling in love with football. And we're speaking in French. And I said to her, why would you do that? And she says, because I knew it would be taken away from me. She does not encourage young Muslim girls to engage in soccer in France because it will be taken away from them. I think that's one of the saddest things I've ever heard in my life. So we're pushing. The Women's World Cup will be played in France next year. So because it's a FIFA-sanctioned tournament, it will go under the umbrella rule that are allowed to play. Thus far, no hijab-wearing players have qualified on their teams. But France itself, you cannot play semi-pro, you can't play recreationally, you can't play at all in France if you wear a foulard, a veil, a headscarf. Can't do it. So that sucks, and I write about it.
Gwendolyn, I wanted to ask you about something that you wrote about in your book that ended up being an excerpt on our website at Sports Illustrated, and it was about the experience of an American player, Danny Foxhoven, in Russia, playing professional soccer in Russia. And I realized that she's an American, but this was outside the U.S. And I think there was the response to this story was in this chapter of your book was shock about the experience that she had. I was wondering if you could share what her experience was.
Yeah, and to be clear, it's not just her experience. I mean, in the chapter talks about, I mean, there are many international women who go to Russia to play because Russia, this country known for oppression, is bizarrely offering them the best financial opportunity to make a, I mean, to make a living playing the game. That's all they're looking for. They're not looking to get rich. They're not going to Russia because like they're getting giant paychecks, but they're getting a decent salary. They can make a living off the game. So it's one thing when you're Danny Foxhoven and you're an American and you don't get paid what the contract tells you. It's another when you're a Cameroonian and your entire family, like you are the breadwinner for your family. And that's why the two Cameroonians that are in my story like are over there. And then so at the end of the season, none of them get paid. But that's not the most shocking part of the story. On Danny Foxhoven's first day in Russia, second practice in Russia, she sits down in the grass and her coach charges her, shouting in Russian, picks her up by the earlobe and slaps her across the face. And that's the beginning of an incredible summer. Apparently they believe that sitting in the grass is bad for a woman's fertility, and as the translator sort of hastily explained. But throughout the summer, they are... He says things like, you all would make a better whore than you are a soccer player. And the level of whores and fucks, and just the translator that I spoke with extensively just said, you know, he used the worst words in the Russian language to talk to these players. And then there were the multicolored vitamins that he would demand that all of the players take without telling them what they are. And the international players would speak up about it, and he would say, no, you've got to take them. And he'd sit there and watch them take the whole cup full of vitamins. And then there were the steroids, where Danny Foxhoven describes how she had an injured hamstring. So he said, here, I've got something for your hamstring. Come with me. And he brings her into his office with the trainer, and they pull down her shorts and insert a needle into her butt cheek, her bare butt cheek, and she like is protesting and saying, no, I'm not comfortable with this. I want a translator. Like, I don't want this. And they're like, no, it's just vitamins. It's just vitamins. And so she believes them. I mean, she doesn't believe it. She hopes that that is the truth. And she goes back to her room with a surging heart and just thinking, like, all I want to do is play women's soccer. I mean, she'd been drafted in the women's U.S. Pro League, but it folded. And as a college player fresh out of the game, there were no other European teams offering a contract. So she's just thinking, like, I'm not going to let this be the end of my career. I'm not giving up. I'm not going home. And Danny Foxhoven was by no means the only woman to, you know, receive an injection. And you know, when she gets home to the U.S., she tests positive for three different types of anabolic steroids. And all of the team. And this wasn't just Russia. I mean, this was Jamaican Amalyn Davis. She locked herself in her room for 4 days and wouldn't come out until they bought her a plane ticket home after they hadn't paid her. And she went in, to play for another league in Eastern Europe, where the whole team had steroid injections right there too. And I mean, it's just women, all they want to do is play and they're willing to go anywhere to make that happen. But there's a tremendous amount of risk. And I'd be remiss not to also talk about Alina Danilova. She's the star of the Russian national team. And her story is about as heartbreaking as it gets. I mean, she grew up in a village and she talks about how like the cow milk and the green pastures were like great for a footballer. And then one day she and her brother, they go to play and they see FC Energia, who's the aforementioned team. And she starts playing with that team when she's 14 years old. And she That team gives her a life, and her father, the one who taught her how to play, walked out on her family, and then her mother died several years later. So she was responsible for providing for her family. So, like, leaving that coach, leaving that team, leaving that situation, she couldn't. And Vera Boquet, a Spanish international player, incredible. She was MVP of the Women's Pro League, the second rendition. She was probably the most well-known player to play for the Russian team, and she talks about, like, the worst part of the experience for her was the way the Russian players were treated. And she said to Danilova, like, you guys don't have to be treated like this. Like, he should not talk to you that. You guys should leave. And Danilova said, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, you guys are international, so you always come here and you complain and you don't like it. You guys can leave. We can't. This is all we have. This is our only option. They were talking particularly about a Georgian player who got the worst of his rants. And, you know, Danilova says she has no education. She has no family. She has nothing. Like, this game is all she has. And Vero sees her the next day, and she's just running laps around the field. And Vero can't speak Russian, and the Georgian can't speak to Vero. But, like, they look at each other, and they just understand, like, as awful as the situation is, like, this game is still what I love, and they're willing to do anything to chase it, which is both inspiring and heartbreaking.
So until now, we've kind of discussed a little bit about specifics on the work of these three women. And at this point, I was hoping we could kind of switch over to having a bit of a discussion between us about equality in global women's soccer. And the first panel, there was quite a bit of discussion about the process that the U.S. women's national team and women's soccer players in the U.S. went through. And in a lot of ways, I would think that has helped influence what we're seeing a bit more recently around the world, where there are quite a few countries now, Nigeria, Ghana, Ireland, Denmark, Brazil, New Zealand, where we're starting to see women's soccer players band together and take a real stand against federations to get better conditions. But I thought that Jean, in our sort of discussion that we had in advance of this panel, brought up a really good question, which is, what would equality look like to each of you? Because that's the theme of what we're here to discuss, but I think people may have different ideas of what that is.
So my take on this is that equal but different systems are never equal. And I think that's the same whether we consider, you know, human rights, civil rights, whether we talk about gender equity, whatever. So, and one of the things I think we have to pay attention to within that is the language that we're using and the narratives that we're using. So I don't hold that women's football is making progress towards some inevitable equity with men's football, because I think the whole narrative around men's football, certainly in the UK, is one of excess. It's too much. The Premiership is overblown. The players are played too much. They, you know, are too indulged. So whereas the whole gendered labour markets of sport have different narratives, I think we need to pay attention to that. So I'm a bit of an old hippie, and so the place that I would like to get to, what would I consider to be equality, would be parity, where we don't talk about men's soccer and women's soccer, we just talk about soccer. I wouldn't have gendered labour markets in sport. I would have labour markets where individuals are picked on individual merit. And I think the amount of time that is spent policing gender difference and gender binary within sport is a whole other topic. And just off the back of that, because I'm an old hippie, How would I like to see men's football change too? Well, you know, there was a lot done during World War One, particularly with the women's teams, but men's teams did it too, where they played games of soccer to raise money for charity. And just think what a different world that would be if football were not such a juggernaut of a business and it was used for charitable purposes rather than for business purposes. So that's my utopia.
For me, the whole idea of equality, equity, is it depends. And I'm going to start at this point because I often look at sport from a global perspective because of my background and my religious identity as well. It depends. You can't paint one solution across the board. I think there are some staples and principles of safety. Moya Dodd, who I think is brilliant, has said, and I've really taken this to heart and held on to it, sport is a birthright of humans, and they have a right to play in peace. They have a right to play in safety, I'm adding my own thing in here, they have a right to choose what they wear when they play. And this is important to me because people don't realize how policies and things like this can exclude. And exclusion from sport is it seems like a minor thing, but it really, sport, I'm sort of a hopeful in that I believe strongly that sport can be used as a vehicle to goodness in this world. It can be used as a way to treat like PTSD from conflicts. We see football being used all the time in refugee camps in Central African Republic or in Jordan and Amman and in Zaatari. We see it with young girls. We see what that does. So for me, using football not just as a business side or as a thinking from a professional level, like loving the game again at a grassroots level and understanding the power of what it is and how it connects 22 people on a pitch with just a ball, which is why it's a global game. You don't need fancy things. You can literally play on the beach in Brazil. You can play in a desert somewhere else. And this is the purity of the sport. And for me, now saying that, there are leagues that people don't know about. For example, the Afghan women's national team doesn't train in Afghanistan. They're paired up with two coaches, former national players. One is Haley Carter, who coaches them out of Dallas. They rely on the friendship and the allyship of other local clubs to support this team. And then some girls go back to Kabul and they train there on their own over YouTube, over Skype with their trainers. Like, it's incredible. You see this. So what their sense of what fairness would be for them looks very different than what it would look like in Trinidad and Tobago, for example, or what it would look like in Ireland, where very recently, and people don't know this, the English national team, the Irish national team boasts a player named Steph Roche, who was nominated for Puskas a couple of years ago. Like, formidable players. They had to take off their track suits in the airport and give them back to the federation. Like, we're talking about, it's mind-boggling. We're talking about Nigeria, who is the continental champions, didn't get a match played for a year because the federation just didn't think it was necessary. For a year, the team didn't play anyone. And finally, they rallied and got to play Cameroon, who also hadn't played for a year. Like, so what that looks like is different. And I will point my fingers at federations here. I mean, I'm constantly literally burning down FIFA metaphorically in my podcast. They have a special incinerator place for us always. But the idea that federations need to be held responsible, these are federations that are supposed to advocate for the players, and they do not do this. And we have talking about opportunities for some players in the global south to have opportunity to play elsewhere, in Bundesliga, in Sweden, in NWSL. Are they advocating for them? Do we even see small leagues? There's a small league at Mogadishu now. Like, this is incredible, and this is very powerful stuff. Do they have those rights to play? We're not even talking about equipment. Like, we're talking about just a safe place to play. Let's even start there. Is there a place that they can play without, you know, without ever what's happening? And keeping in mind that a lot of the places in the world that I look at, they're not stable geopolitically. And, you know, the men's side might have a team, but the women certainly don't. And, you know, what does that look like? We know that Egypt is going to the World Cup and it's brilliant. What does the women's team look like? Does anyone even know that they played in the African Championship? And they actually have players that are from the diaspora that are around. So you've got a friend of mine in Toronto who actually plays for Egypt. She was born and raised in Canada, but has dual citizenship. So you often find even within those countries, girls don't have access to it the way they need to. So we're talking about, there's so many things that can be done here. And I'm super hopeful in even having these conversations. And also, in order to get equity, the one thing I'll say, and I've always said, you need women at the table. You need women at every level. We need decision makers that are women, women in FIFA. That's a hashtag, women in FIFA, in the federations, and not just planted there because they have a uterus, planted there because they really care about the game. And that's really important, is to have women in not just player roles, as officials, as coaches. Somebody raised this point earlier. What did the amount of coaches look like? Where are they? Are they there? I mean, we could talk about the FA and Mark Sampson and all we want, but there needs to be, girls need to see themselves represented. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. So, you know, owners, you know, financiers, lawyers, business managers, we need to see women across the board, literally still solving, creating solutions to the problems that men create in football.
So the 2016 Olympics were kind of huge and kind of pointless for the Brazilian women's national team, where the men were having a terrible opening group stage, anemic goal scoring. They weren't scoring goals. They were playing traditionally weak teams, and they just weren't doing what Brazilians are supposed to do. Meanwhile, the Brazilian women were putting on goal fests and just scoring spectacular goals. And Marta has been around like forever. Not really. 2007 was her incredible explosion onto the world scene, and she was 17 years old, and all of us watching were like, who is that? I've never seen anything like that. But the Brazilians weren't watching. They had no idea that she existed. And I went and played in Brazil in 2000, and I played in 05, and everywhere I went, I asked, have you heard of Marta? Like, do you know Marta? No one, not the acai vendors, not the taxi drivers, no one had heard of Marta, even though in the U.S. she was, I mean, we did. In 2007, she got the chance to play in front of, on her home soil in the Pan American Games, and no one came to the games in the beginning, but then she scored 4 goals against Ecuador and 5 goals against the next team, and suddenly, like, the news spread of this girl who could score as many goals as Pele and do it in as spectacular of a fashion. So then they came. They filled Maracanã Stadium, which, as Grant Wall once beautifully wrote, it's like the spiritual home of Brazilian football. And so then they were aware of her. Suddenly they knew about her. But even in spite of, so Brazilians have this word called Jinga, and it's like has to do with a sublime combo of imagination and footwork. And she had so much of it, and it kind of was able to overpower their machismo and their prejudice against women playing football, and so they knew of her, but still women's football they didn't actually care about until that 2016 Olympics, where the men and the women are playing and you're just watching the women dominate and the men do poorly in the beginning, and so at the end of the men's games they started chanting Marta, 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 and then they the jerseys. There were little boys who were crossing out Neymar on the back of their jerseys and writing Marta. And that's not just them making a statement. I mean, they were making a statement, but it is also impossible in Brazil to buy a Marta jersey. The street vendors don't have them. The stores don't have them. There was a Brazilian kind of soap opera star who starts tweeting about his outrage that he could not buy himself a Marta jersey. And I say all of this because if the media doesn't invest, if the federations don't invest, women aren't a part of the national conversation. And I think that for me, equality looks like even attention from both the media and the federations. And if you give even attention, then there's an audience. And then when there's an audience, there's revenue. And when there's revenue, you can create stronger salaries. And I mean, it's all so linked together. And in Brazil, it's a gigantic country, and if I'd have you guess how many youth teams there are, but there's like 10. I mean, there's probably 10 youth soccer clubs in Durham alone, and in Brazil there are 10. 10 girls' soccer clubs. So if you're a girl, you've got the street. You can play with the boys. And that makes many of Brazilians incredible. But just imagine how good they'd be if they did have any sort of infrastructure, any sort of youth club teams. And the Brazilian women's players themselves have been fighting like hell to change that. They're going into the favelas, into communities, and are showing themselves. They are just, they're doing what Carla was talking about that the U.S. team was doing, but with no World Cup to try to get seats for, just to do it, just so that these girls know, hey, you are allowed to play, look what you can be. And they're making huge changes, and there are more. I mean, there's a woman in Sao Paulo who just, she organizes pickup games, peladas, they call them in Brazil, and 500 girls show up. And so it is majorly changing, but I just, just equal attention would do so much. Like Shireen says, the grassroots level is where I'm really, you know, passionate.
That's it for part one of our panel discussion. Look for part two to be released later this week. Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Gene Williams, Shireen Ahmed, and Gwendolyn Oxenham, as well as Duke's Laurent Dubois and Eliza Dandridge, in addition to everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help the cause if you do. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available on Amazon and Fubo TV. Recent guests include Becky Sauerbrunn, John Strong, Rory Smith, and Stuart Holden. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.